Welcome to Mighty Parenting, the podcast with real, raw, and relevant talk about raising teens and parenting young adults. Here are your hosts, Judy Davis and Sandy Fowler.
Welcome to Mighty Parenting, a community where we help you raise teens and parent 20-somethings so they can become happy, successful, and emotionally healthy adults. I am Judy Davis, and I am here with my co-host and longtime friend, Sandy Fowler. And I just want to take a moment before we get started today to thank each and every one of you for everything you do to support our podcast. Whether it's sharing a show that you know that someone needs that particular message, or you have decided that you want access to show extras and additional interviews through our private membership area, we appreciate and see everything you're doing, every comment, every like, every share, and we just want to thank you for helping keep us on the air so we can impact families in such a tangible way. It's our passion, and you are helping us bring it to life. So we appreciate each and every one of you so much. And today's topic, it's one, you know, I can't tell you how many times that I have been part of a conversation or have overheard parents talking about the horrible teenage years and all that they're dealing with and how they feel like everything they do is met with a brick wall and that parenting efforts are just feeling like they're a lost cause. And I'm not going to lie, there have been times throughout my journey that I've thrown my hands up in the air and gone, what in the world am I doing? How have I let it get to this point? And I even questioned, where did the kid that I raised go? Because this person in front of me is not there. It's like, at one moment, my kids are out there picking dandelions and ringing to me saying, Mommy, you're the best. And the next moment, they're slamming doors and walking away. So it became really difficult for me. I know, Sandy, we've talked about this just in general often.
Yeah, we did. And, you know, and we've said it before, and I'm going to say it again. Parenting is hard. There are so many angles. There are multiple people involved, and we're all doing our best. If you are here listening, as we've said before, you're a mighty parent, and you are doing the best you can. So kudos to you, hugs to you if it's hard. And just remember, you know, one thing is certain, and that is that, as you show by being here, being willing to say there's a problem, and then identifying why something is happening, that's what starts us on the road to change. And to me, this idea that a parent can be bullied by a child, I mean, that's just something I've never heard anyone discuss before. I've heard parents who are at the end of their rope, and I've listened to them, and I've sat with them. And now what I'm thinking is that many of them were actually being bullied. Now that I've read Sean's book, I'm like, oh my gosh, what an eye-opener. And so that makes me so happy to have Sean Grover here with us today to shed light on the situation. After reading his book, I really do. I see just how often this can happen. So having his wisdom, his experience, and his advice available to all our mighty parenting peeps makes me really happy. And the best part is that even if you aren't in a situation where you're being bullied by your child, there are still great parenting lessons for all of us, bullied or not. And Sean is going to be chatting with us. He is a psychotherapist, an author, and a father with 25 years of experience helping parents fend off nervous breakdowns, including his own, he says. And he is the author of the parenting book, When Kids Call the Shots: How to Seize Control from Your Darling Bully and Enjoy Parenting Again. So, Sean, as you can hear, we're glad to have you here. Thanks for joining our Mighty Parenting community today.
Thank you, Sandy and Judy, and greetings from New York City.
Oh, yes.
We are truly coast to coast today, and I'm just sitting in the middle.
Exactly. At least, you know, are you guys freezing cold out there still? We got some sunshine, so for once, the Pacific Northwest is warmer than everywhere else in the country.
Yeah, although I'll point out that by the time this airs, one will hope that New York warms up because That's true. Be May by then. So, but, you know, Sean, as I said in the beginning, this idea that kids can bully their parents, for many of us, it's shocking. And yet sometimes, and I'm sure there are parents who are listening today who are like, oh my gosh, yes, that's what's happening. I'm being bullied. So I guess what I want to talk about first is what it looks like when a teen is bullying their parent. I mean, how can we recognize that this is what's actually happening?
Well, you know, I'm always amazed. Yesterday in my office, I had this situation where a mother and her son came in. He was about 12 years old. And I'm sitting listening to them, and I'm astonished at the way he's talking to her. He's telling her to get a life, get over yourself. She's trying to explain what's going on. He's going, blah, blah, blah. This is boring. Talking over her. So nature puts parents and their children on a collision course. In adolescence, kids want to have their own identity. They want to separate. They want to be out on their own. But they're still dependent on their parents. So there's this push-pull aspect. But the bully dynamic, I think, is really born maybe in this generation. We're trying to find a new parenting model. We don't want to be the critical, hostile, or dictatorial parents of the past. So we're trying to be nicer and kinder and more flexible. But maybe we've gone too far. So we're not setting limits. We're not labeling what's appropriate, what isn't appropriate. I mean, the level of disrespect that this young boy showed his mother within the first 10 minutes of our session really, really just shocked me. And what was even more surprising is it was life as normal for them. She had no idea that that was inappropriate. And that most parents don't realize. We've all been out in public and seen like a meltdown in a playground or a shopping center. And that's kind of temper tantrum material. It's kind of normal during elementary school. But if you don't resolve those sort of core issues, to tolerate frustration, to delay gratification, if you let them continue to be unresolved, you wind up with a very big little person, a teenager who thinks that all they need to do to get their way is to push you around. And it works, so they continue. They grow older, but they don't mature.
What I'm hearing you say is that these behavior patterns start way early on and just kind of escalate. Is that correct?
They escalate if they're not addressed. You can't parent effectively unless your child is a little afraid of you. Because that fear helps them to put the brakes on. So if those challenges, those testing moments, if a child isn't helped to resolve them in a positive way and they just continue to bully or test and get their way, then yes, that dynamic, that early dynamic of temper tantrums, they can last a lifetime. And actually, there's been studies on children who haven't had good limits put on them, who are overindulged, who develop as adults, they get into abusive relationships, they develop credit card debt, gambling, possibility for addiction. All these things really spring from those very early experiences where these conflicts weren't resolved in a way that helped the child to mature. It may have satisfied them, they got what they wanted, but they didn't learn to hold back and work for getting it themselves, rather than trying to extract it from their parents.
So are there certain behavior patterns that can kind of give us that red flag alert that unhealthy patterns are emerging, or is it all kind of the same?
I think it depends on the culture of your family. You really have to look at the whole family. I think the minute a child, as early as possible, tips towards name calling, right? Is that okay in your house if you're calling someone lazy or stupid or anything? If that's a normal occurrence, then that family has a culture of disrespect. So those little testing moments, you really want to capture them and say, hey, wait a minute. We don't talk to each other like that in this family. And really put down a strong framework of expectations for behaviors that you're, of course, you're modeling these behaviors, but also that children don't have natural impulse control. They don't have great decision making. So they need you to help pause and help them develop those skills. So look, we're going to stop right here. What's going on? Why are you so upset? Let's help them to find the words to express themselves and then give them options if they're angry, if they're upset, if they want something. What are the options here besides bullying or yelling or attacking the person verbally?
So what I heard you talk about there, Sean, is I want to make sure I got this. So what we're looking for are repeated actions from our child that are outside of our family's framework for whatever's acceptable or respectful behavior.
That's right. That's exactly right.
And as I'm thinking about this, I think that as parents, a lot of times we will allow our kids to treat us in ways that we wouldn't allow them to treat other members of the family or people outside the family. I think when, especially as teenagers, we do that. Oh, I got it. You know, is this the hill I want to die on? I got to, you know, pick my battles. All those mantras go through our head and we end up accepting behavior that's not acceptable.
That's right. Absolutely. And that's why most parents, even the term bullied parent, if I bring that up in a session, they look kind of stunned. They have to kind of think about that for a minute. And you have to help them to see that this isn't normal. And most of all, this is not helping your child.
Yeah, well, and I got that. That was really interesting when you listed off some of the problems that these kids have as adults. You know, the gambling, addiction, abusive relationships, debt, credit card debt. That was really interesting that, you know, those are some of the things that happen to them. So in that, like you said, you know, parents, you get surprised because you're like, whoa, I'm being bullied. But, and that's kind of the feeling. I haven't experienced being a bullied parent. But when I read your book, or actually when I first saw your book, like that was what came to me. I was like, oh my gosh, parents are bullied. And I started that going back through my memory banks of helping, you know, friends or acquaintances or just listening to people in forums or meetings or whatever. But I also did kind of take a look at some things in my life to go, wait, am I allowing bullying behaviors? And what was interesting that brought it up to me now was it was the feeling I got, and still sometimes happens. There are certain things that my child can do, and it makes me feel, I think probably feel bullied in that moment. I feel kind of like I'm out of control. I feel small. I'm like looking around, grasping, going, oh my gosh, what do I do? Like, it's almost, what do I do to just make this stop in this moment? And I've had
That's
to kind
right.
of take that step back and go, okay, so what are you allowing? What's the scenario? What am I doing that's encouraging my kid to behave this way? And kind of going through that in those feelings. And so I was wondering if we could look at some of the different ways that kids do bully, because I think that this is a hard concept to get our mind around, of what it looks like when a child bullies a parent. And in your book, you talk about different bullying styles. I think we can kind of relate more to this one example that you gave us because it's a very intense kind of in your face type of thing, but you talk about different styles of bullying.
That's right. You got, if you look at every child has unique character traits or personalities. I'm always amazed at how different my children are. And if I think about even the way they were born under such different circumstances. So parenting doesn't determine who the child is as much as it helps to shape the child in terms of how they interact, how they relate, how they express themselves. So we're looking at, when we look at these common scenarios, we'll take a look at, for example, the defiant child. It's a child that is always going against, you say left, they go right, you say right, they go left, you say yes, they say no. They're always pushing back, pushing back, pushing back. And the defiant child really wants to run the show. Every child goes through a phase of that where they go through a testing period. How much power can I take? If they can, they will take over the parenting and parent you. So with the defiant bully, it's very important that we establish family meetings where we discuss conflict, that we plan ahead for mornings. If we have a rush morning, everyone has to get out. How can we preempt all the, I always ask parents, make a list of where all the conflicts are about to occur. Early in the morning, before bed, give me your top 10 in terms of conflict. And then we go, look, how can we prevent that? What can we do to precipitate that conflict? And generally, I find that children have, they have more feelings than words. So if a child bullying or acting out, generally something's missing. They're in pain in some way. They need something they're not getting.
And this is true for teens too. This isn't just little kids.
Especially for teens. A lot, when I work with a teenager's family, the parents are so exhausted by the teenage years. And I'll say, and they sort of throw their hands up and walk away, many of them. Fine, have it your way. But actually, that's when these limits, structure limits and boundaries are needed the most, because teenagers are all about impulsivity, all about running into situations without thinking. So when parents apply limits, curfews, responsibilities in terms of chores and help them to get maybe an internship or find a job, all these structures really help the child to mature, and the bullying is much less likely to occur. But the more you provide for your child, the more that you gift them or give them, the more they expect and the less they appreciate. So you enter down this long road. You get this sinking feeling that you can't do anything right. And when you're in that zone, we really have to step back and reboot your parenting.
Okay, so this was the defiant bully we started with. I'm sorry, I got you kind of off track there. So that's one bullying style looks like. There are, what, two more, right?
Yeah, the anxious bully. Generally, the anxious bully is a kid who anxious bullies often have anxious parents, a parent that's always worrying, always doubtful, always concerned, and they're communicating to the child that they don't have confidence in them, that the world's a scary place, that you have to stay attached to me to be successful. And children don't like that. So they're trying to separate, but they're getting all these negative messages. So it makes them very anxious. So they're always pushing the parent away. They're always trying to find space. They're feeling intruded upon. They feel like the parent overshares. Maybe there's an imbalance in the relationship. If there are two parents, maybe they have different parenting styles. That can drive a kid absolutely crazy. So with anxious boys, they're just trying to carve out some space for them, and they start to push back. And they need to find a way. Well, let me take that again. They push back until the parent sets limits. Often a child's pushing is an unconscious wish for limits. And parents confuse limits as punishment. They are not limits, punishment. They limits are love, in terms of when a child knows what the expectations are, can live within this framework of the culture of the family, they're much less likely to be anxious and much less likely to bully.
Can you dig in a little bit there, Sean, about limits versus punishment? Because I think that's a concept that as parents, no matter what style of bullying you're talking about, that is a really fine line. So I'd like to can you just kind of define that a little more? Like, what would be a healthy limit and where parents might think it's a punishment?
Right. Well, let's look at technology. That's something that I'm asked to talk about a lot these days. Technology is a wonderful tool. It should never be a way of life. Limits on technology. Every family I work with, I ask them to have a tech contract that everyone follows. That means there are tech blackouts. Technology goes off at 9:00. The router is turned off. There are no cell phones in the room. There are no laptops. If we're on vacation, you get your phone for 30 minutes in the morning and 30 minutes at night. But in the middle of the day, it's just us. So these are the kind of structures. There's no technology at the table. If we're eating dinner, no one's on the phone, including mom and dad. It's amazing when children have unrestricted access to technology, they become more impulsive, less mindful. A lot of studies, one I read recently where they found a reduction in the most basic language skills, emotional intelligence. So if they don't have limits on technology, they're going to be more anxious. They're going to be more consumed. Their sleep is going to be set off. They're going to be worried about they're going to be exposed to things maybe they're not ready to be exposed to. So anytime a family puts down limits around technology as the culture of the family, they're always amazed. They'll say there's a big pushback in the beginning, but within 2 or 3 days, the household seems much calmer. The children are reading again, or they're playing guitar. They're doing things they hadn't done. So that's just an example of like putting limits down so to help a child contain those impulses. Because they'd be on the, I'm sure many parents listening have woken up in the middle of the night and discovered their kids on their phone or on the laptop or on their iPad. And if it's 3 in the morning, that's going to be a tough morning getting that kid ready and out the door for school.
And it's any time that you take away or put limits, especially on tech, that one most definitely, it probably does initially feel like a punishment to the kids. Another thing with this whole setting limits thing that we talk about a lot here at Mighty Parenting, because we are focusing primarily on our teens and our 20-somethings. And so Judy and I are big advocates of the idea of having discussions with our kids about things. Like when we did our, you know, dealing with your teenager and college student this summer episode, we really encourage parents to have conversations with their kids about what do the kids want for this summer? What are their expectations about it? And what are the parents? As we are doing that and opening up that conversation and asking our kids, what are you expecting? What do you think? That's another area, you know, like Judy brought up, I can totally see where it would be easy for parents to go, oh, well, this is what they want and this is what they're thinking. And wow, they came up with their own plan for the summer. So we need to do that. What I hear you saying is that that's still not a good idea, that we still need to have some limits, even when we're working together in concert with them, that we still need to say, hey, yeah, your plan for the summer is great. We love that you came up with one. And we are a family. We still have family time, or we have family dinners, or we have whatever is important in our family framework. We still need to set those limits that you need to do this, or this is how we function. Is that right? Am I getting that?
Yeah, that absolutely. Line? Because yes, at family meetings, I used to dread a family meeting as a child because that was generally meant my father ranting for 45 minutes and just waiting, please let this end. But a family meeting is where we sit down and we discuss as a family what's coming up. What do we have coming up? We have camp coming up. We have this coming up. You have a big test. It's a community meeting where children, the difficulty is, if you have a conflict with your kid or if something goes wrong, generally people have discussions at the worst time. Everyone's trying to get out the door. Now I'm going to tell you everything you're doing wrong. Or we're up really late or someone's sick and now we're going to talk about how the family functions. No. So we want to pick a time where everyone can sit down and talk through these things. And that we, if you said your, if a child gets a job or something, that's fantastic. I would throw myself behind that all the way. But I have a job. Does that mean I stop cleaning around the house? Does that mean I stop all my responsibilities because I have this one big thing I'm doing? So it provides a safe space for working through conflicts and expectations together. And the more you approach a child from a family perspective, this, we're talking about everyone, mom, dad, your sister, your brother, this is how we are, the less they feel singled out and ganged up on. Often we'll focus on the child that's having problems or causing problems, and it becomes this big imbalance in the family. So that the family meeting is to reboot that. Often I'll have, if there's a child in the family that's having the difficulty of being really disruptive, I bring the whole family in. I want to see the whole family because everyone's got a piece of that. So the family meeting really is a safe space for going through conflict, expectations, see what's coming up. It provides a framework, and anxiety loves structure. And teenagers, they're all anxious. So if you have structure in place, flexible structures, they're going to feel more secure. During the summer, for example, if you have no structure, and this often happens, where kids are sleeping all day and then they're up all night, you'll begin to see their mood starts to get worse and worse. They become more impulsive, more critical, maybe more bullying. They can't function well without structure. So providing it for your child is a real necessity.
Well, and I think so often parents, as our kids get older, we want to let them choose more things or have more control of their life. And, you know, bedtime or curfew tends to be one of those things that becomes fluid. And up to this point, you know, we've talked a lot about how the parents are feeling. And, you know, when we're talking about limits and things like that, on the flip side, how are our kids feeling? Why are they needing to push back or, for better terms, bully us to get what they want? What is going on in our kids' mind to have them feel like they need to react in this way?
Well, generally, we want to look at the whole family. If a child's acting out in some way, they may be, in the best way they can, raising a red flag that I need help. So often when a child comes in, I'll look at, you know, the parents, like I said earlier, if they have different parenting styles, maybe one's a permissive parent and one is more the taskmaster and they're at odds with each other. Or maybe there's a sick child in the family where the child feels that one child's getting all the attention. Or maybe there's been a separation or a divorce where the parent feels guilty about the outcome and is trying to compensate for that by being over generous or over accommodating to a child. So anytime I look at that behavior, I look at really look at it as a symptom of some global problem within the family. And or if a child's acting out, there's no child I know who wants to do badly in school. There's no child I know who wants to score badly on tests. Often there may be a learning disability that's undiagnosed, that's creating enormous pressure on that child to go in day after day and do their best and do poorly. Eventually they just give up. So take that behavior as a symptom first, and then we begin to walk back and see, do they have tension outlets? Are they exercising? Are they models and mentors? I do this talk called The Five Things Every Teenager Needs, where if children have these five things, you're much less likely to see these behavior problems. But without those basic fundamental needs, you're going to have a child that's very disagreeable.
All right, Sean, we don't have time to discuss these five things, but I have to know what they are. Can you just list them for us?
Oh, yeah. Okay. So the first one is tension outlet. That's a cardio workout. That means studies have shown that a cardio workout, 30 minutes or more, three times a week, reduces an anxiety and depression symptom up to 70%. So teenagers have more feelings and words. They store a lot of tension in the body, which becomes psychic tension, becomes muscle tension, becomes headaches, backaches, nail biting, picking up themselves. So a tension outlet, like a good cardio workout, it can be non-competitive, it can be swimming, it can be running, it can be, you can do a dance class with them. Amazing the change you'll see. Number two, we touched on was the structure, limits, and boundaries. That's maintaining these things at home, maintaining communication, maintaining a culture of mutual respect. Number three, we're looking at models and mentors. If you can find, this is really the express lane, if you can find an adult outside the orbit of your family that your kid looks up to and can mentor, you'll see enormous changes in that child. We talked about the learning diagnostic. First thing you want to consider if your kid's really, really struggling in school, you want to see, you know, what's going on there. Is there something else that could be causing? You know, they're walking around with so much tension and it's erupting, and if they have a learning disability, that could certainly be the cause of that. Okay, and so the fifth one we really want to look at is self-esteem building activities. These are activities that children develop their natural talents and abilities. Every child should have three to five sources for self-esteem. That means they play an instrument, maybe they're good at art, they're good at sports, something that's really unique. That they can draw on. These things will really insulate them when life gets rough. So if a child's not doing well in school, but is a great musician or a great athlete, that helps to balance the score. So self-esteem building activities come from basic raw talents and abilities that you really want to help your child to develop.
Well, and we've heard similar vein of things too from other guests. The learning diagnostics. We did a show in April with Elaine, where she talked to us about learning differences. In addition to learning disabilities, there are also the learning differences. So that show ties in. And then the self-esteem, Tatcha and Ron in their book on success, and we'll put in the show notes which episodes these actually are, but they talked about passion projects. So it's just really interesting to me that all these different ideas come together and start blending. And actually makes me feel good because it's not like I have 47,000 different parenting things I need to do.
Exactly.
You know, it's kind of this underlying, like you said, you know, give them these five things, set the limits and structures, and I don't have to come up with new things to do. But I'm also going to loop us back around because the conversations are so interesting. We talked about the defiant bully. We talked about the anxious bully. Sean, we need our third bullying type.
My third bullying is the manipulative bully.
Ooh.
These are kids that can really sense. They're really clever at getting what they want in an indirect way. So a child that senses, let's say we have a guilty parent, Sharon has been through a divorce or some other hardships of family, they sense that if they press this sensitive area enough, the parent will give them what they want. An example of this is I worked with a young man whose mother was a single mom, and she missed his concert at school. He was playing in the band and she missed it, and he got very, very upset and wouldn't talk to her and was furious, and it went on forever. And when I was talking to him in therapy, I said, well, you know, your mom's doing the best she can, why are you, just cut her some slack here, it's the first thing she's missed in a long time. And he said, no, not going to do it. I said, why not? He said, because if I keep it up a little while longer, I'm pretty sure I can get a new laptop. So he knew he knew what he was doing. So the manipulative bully really is very sneaky and clever, and actually has a lot of talent in terms of people skills, but is using them to extract their wants out of the parents in very devious ways.
Well, so that's where I'm kind of going, okay, you know, on the one hand, great, they have these people skills, and yes, people want things, teenagers want more than the average person sometimes, and they don't have all the emotional and mental ability yet to manage all of that. But is there something else going on that we should be looking at? You know, so for example, you told us, well, in the book, you said that the defiant bully feels they're not seen. And then when we were talking today, you said the anxious bully needs limits. Is there something like that going on with the manipulative bully, or is this just, hey, you know, I'm giving in to my baser selfish tendencies here?
Yeah, I think, again, we're going to look at that manipulation as a reaction to a situation. So maybe they feel they aren't heard. Maybe they feel, every kid in a family feels one of their siblings gets more attention, or one of the siblings isn't handled as strictly as they are. There's some sort of, that's what I mean, in the family meeting, if we can talk these things through, if children can put these feelings into words, there's much less likely they're going to deal with being manipulative or going behind your back. So, yeah, we want to look for what's that symptom being caused by. Maybe are they being bullied in school? Are they a social outcast? A lot of times a parent will come in very angry at their child for doing things, and I spend a little time with their child, and I'll say, they've been in a lot of pain for a long time. Are you aware of what's going on at school? And most kids will hide that. They're ashamed. They're embarrassed. They don't want their parents to know. It feels like a failure. So as they're suppressing all that, you get these bizarre behaviors like the manipulation or lying and everything. That's just a symptom. We've got to look behind that. What is what is causing that to erupt in that way.
Yeah, I looked back at my notes, and I really like the way you put this in the book. You said they're trying to manage their feelings and emotions by managing their environment. Yeah. So what I'm kind of getting then is that we need to teach our kids how to handle their feelings and emotions. How do we do that? Especially, again, if we're into the teenage years or tweens or 20s, you know, this is not a small child who, when their balloon lets go, you know, we can go, okay, well, this is going to make them feel sad. We can talk through those feelings. Things are different and a little sometimes more difficult during these years. How can we teach our kids when they're older to manage feelings and emotions?
Yeah. Well, the first thing we want to look at is how you model it yourself. When my kids were much younger, and I was a first-time father, oh my gosh, I lost my temper all the time. And I came from a family, I was raised in a family, which we all lost our temper all the time. And suddenly I had a child that was losing her temper all the time. And the book really came out of my own struggle as a parent. I had to sort of take a hard look at my own choices. So modeling mindfulness or sharing with your child your own struggle. Let me back this up a second. The best way, the least effective ways of talking to teenagers are advice, criticism, and comparison. Those are the three things I see most often in my office. It's going to shut them down in record time. Giving advice, criticizing them, or comparing them to their siblings or other golden children and their relatives. No child is going to respond to that. So in terms of getting them, speaking with them, I always advise, do not, if there are two parents, don't approach the child together. That's two against one. That's going to cause a lot of, already they're defensive when two parents come. You've got to find activities. Teenagers love, they need some activity to discharge your anxiety. So if they're going for a walk, if you're going for a drive, you take riding on a bike, if you're doing things, that's a perfect time to initiate a conversation. And always listen more than you talk. That is so important. And choose events that are outside. If you say to a child, how do you feel about this? Often putting them on the hot seat, it's not helpful to them in terms of getting to explore what they're feeling. But if you say, I heard this is happening at that school, have you heard about that? And the child will talk about that. Or I remember when I was your age and I was terrified of speaking up in class. And, oh, really? You know, so you're really meeting them where they're at. We're not cornering them and trying to extract feelings from them. We're helping them, walking them through modeling, through exploring these examples from outside the family, through creating space where they're going to talk and you're going to listen. Explain that to me exactly. What does that mean? When you said that, you were so angry. What was going on? Revisiting a moment from it, maybe something went bad in the morning. You can always, apologizing is a wonderful example. I've often said to my kids, I wish I handled that differently. I'm not proud of how I behaved in that moment. And then remarkably, they will say that to you when they have a bad moment. And then we can see that people have bad moments. No one's condemned for that. So really providing those spaces for them to explore what they're feeling and then leading them is really what they need most.
I love using media to get some of these conversations going. Because we'll see something on TV or hear something in a song on the radio or a conversation. And similar to like you said, well, I heard this is going on in this school. And I can pull something from a movie or a TV show we were watching and go, wow, you know, I'm really surprised they handled it this way. Or this really shocked me. Or, huh, that was really interesting. What did you think about that? Or even being able to look at a situation and go, wow, I wish I was handling I wish I would handle some of these things in my life more like that. You know, I had this come up. And similar to the apologizing, it's pointing out to them that, hey, maybe I'm not always handling my emotions and my feelings in the best way, but I'm working on it and I'm learning. And so I can point out to them when I screw it up, when I mess it up, so that they know that that's not the healthy way to do it. And that can open the door to that conversation of going, yeah, I wished I'd done it that way. Well, I'm trying to find a better way to do it. Or I found this thing and I'm testing it out. As much as we talk about the media, it can be a great tool.
and no one is condemned for making a mistake. You create a culture where I made a mistake, you make a mistake, we're going to do the things differently. But often we sort of condemn children. So how could you have done that? You know, but actually they're just doing the best they can. That's how they learn. They screw up just like adults. We screw up and we learn from that too.
And so as parents, I mean, kind of to what I'm getting here is as a parent, I really need to step back and engage with my child, not do the advice and criticize and compare, because that's just like adding fuel to the flame when it comes to them acting out and bullying. So is there any other little tips or nuggets of that I can do as a parent so that I can figure out what is really going on? I know for me, a lot of times if there's been issues with my kids, it'll boil down to something that comes from my background that I've brought along the way. So I'd love to just really quickly kind of touch on that a little. If, you know, how do we figure out what the bullying side of it is coming from if we don't have some tangible things? I don't know if I'm explaining that really well.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. When I started to work on this book and I presented it to publishers, I was writing a manual for parents to work on themselves, to understand themselves better, to engage in kind of an analysis of their own upbringing and where they came from and the culture and values of the family. And when I presented it to the publisher, they said, oh, this is very interesting and this is going to help a lot of parents, but it's never going to sell. I said, well, why not? And they said, because parents don't want to work on themselves. They want to blame their children. So I went through a big crisis with the publisher. I was actually thinking of walking away from the deal. They said, okay, tell you what, we're going to change the title. We're going to mix it up a little bit. You can keep your message, but we're going to come at it differently. So the book really focuses on these bullied children, these kind of tyrant children. But if you look through the first two or three chapters, I'm giving parents a whole lot of homework before we even get to their child. How were they raised? What was effective in their household? Did they have a single parent? Did they have a missing parent? All these things really impact the choices we make as parents. And the greater self-understanding that we have about where we've come from, then we can make conscious choices not to repeat patterns or not to make a decision in defiance of our upbringing. For example, when a child, you grow up with a strict parent and you decide, I'm never going to be strict, that comes now with a whole new set of problems. So self-understanding and understanding me with my daughters when they were younger, how that that pattern of losing your temper or blowing up or threatening, I was just carrying that forward. I really wasn't thinking. I was modeling impulsivity and patience. I was a terrible model for my children. So when they started yelling at me or screaming at me or screaming at each other, I had to take full responsibility for that. I planted that seed. And so the greater self-understanding of your past and your upbringing, the greater mindfulness you can bring as a parent to your choices and how you choose to raise your kids rather than unconsciously repeating patterns.
You're talking about that, and I'm chuckling over here because when our kids were probably around fourth grade-ish, I remember talking to my husband and going, okay, the most aggravating things that they do are on us. They're the most aggravating things that we do. They're just even more irritating when they're coming from our children.
That's right. And oh, you want to go ahead.
No, I was just saying, and it is, it's that learned behavior. They learned it because just like they learned to walk and to talk, they have our accent because they learned to talk by listening to us. Well, they learned to function and to behave and to manage their feelings and their emotions by watching us. And none of us are perfect at it. So our kids aren't either.
That's right. But if we're working on it, if we're consciously working on it, we can make choices that they'll begin to play back to us. You know, this is an interesting phenomenon that I've noticed. It's kind of a secret I'm going to share with you. The child that you have the most difficulty getting along with, I found, is the most like you.
Yes.
Parents hate to hear that, but you are bringing your whole history into your parenting. So whatever difficulties you have in your life in relationships, you're going to have with your children. So if you're a really controlling person, a dominating person, you're going to have children that are going to be one controlling and dominating. So the more you can take a good look in the mirror and see these tendencies, the more empowered you are as a parent to take your kids down a different path.
It is. And it's all, there's so much here, Sean, that's so interesting. And we're going to have to wrap up. I am going to ask, though, if you could do a little extra piece after we wrap up this show, because we're running out of podcast time. We'll have in our bonus area for people, we've talked about how the bullying can happen over a long period of time, but you also talk in your book about how a parenting crisis can do that. So after we finish this up, we'll talk a little about that and make that available in the bonus material. But okay. This was eye-opening. And number one, just to realize that, yeah, parents can be bullied by their children. And there's a whole spectrum of that. If we're in a situation where we just don't feel like we can handle it, then we need to go to professionals. But there's a lot that we can do. And first is just to notice what's happening and what's going on and to look for some of those red flags. If our kids are acting in a way that is outside of the acceptable family framework for respectful behavior, then we can start looking at going, huh, what's going on? And there are three different kinds of bullying behaviors from our kids. There's the defiant bully, who is very confrontational and oppositional. And if you let them, they will take over the parenting and they will parent you. There's the anxious bully, who often has anxious parents, and they're trying to separate, but they're getting these messages that might not be safe. So you'll feel like they're always pushing you away, that they want their space. And what they really need are some limits, some loving, caring limits, and some flexible structure. And then we have our manipulative bully. And they're the ones who have great people skills and they're really clever at getting what they want. So what they try to do is to manage their environment as a way of managing their feelings and emotions. And there are five things that every teenager needs. We can help our kids get these things, which will help them manage those feelings and emotions. We need to give them attention outlet. We need to give them structure with limits and boundaries, get them models and mentors, possibly do learning diagnostics, and make sure that they have self-esteem building activities. And we need to model this behavior of managing our feelings and our emotions for our kids. And we may identify areas where we are not doing that well by watching our children. So we can watch them and then we can look at modeling that. And when we go to talk to them, avoid advice, criticism, and comparisons, and make sure that we're listening more than we talk. Approach them individually. Don't gang up on them. Don't have both parents or other adults chiming in. Just have one adult talking to them individually. And you said that doing that during an activity is a great way to do that. And just let them know that everybody makes mistakes. No one is condemned for making a mistake. Sean, there's so much here. Like I said, we'll have our bonus piece, but what website can people go to get more from you, connect with you? Of course, we have the book on our show notes available there, but I'm sure it's also, well, actually, I know it's also on your website. Could you share that?
Sure, absolutely. My website is seangrover.com. There's videos there, parenting videos. There's tons of articles and suggestions. It's all free. There's no advertising. If you go to that website, you can search things. Your show will be linked to that website. I try to provide a library that parents can turn to and with questions and answers. And there's everything there I think you'd really need.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today and being part of our community, Sean. I know that everything that you've given us is things that parents can take away and implement in their lives so that they can grow with their kids and end this cycle if it happens to be showing up in our families. Just want to say, if you want the bonus content that we're talking about speaking to Sean with, you can just go to mightyparenting.com/support and learn how to access all of the bonus content, including that extra interview. And if you are here listening, remember, you are a mighty parent, and Sandy and I will see you next week.